Side 2. All Tomorrow's Parties by William Gibson. Continuing on page 40. Once, before he'd come to Tokyo, Lainey woke in the bedroom of his suite in the chateau. It was dark, only a shush of tires up from sunset, muffled drumming of a helicopter hunting the hills behind. And the hole, right there beside him, in the lonely queen-size expanse of his bed. The hole, up close and personal. 9. Sweep second. Bright pyramids of fruit beneath buzzing neon. He watches as the boy drains a second liter of the pulped drink, swallowing the entire contents of the tall plastic cup in an unbroken stream with no apparent effort. You should not drink cold things so quickly. The boy looks at him. There is nothing between the boy's gaze and his being. No mask. No personality. He is not, apparently, deaf, because he has understood the suggestion of the cold drink. But there is no evidence as yet that he is capable of speech. Do you speak Spanish? This, in the language of Madrid, unspoken for many years. The boy places the empty cup beside the first one and looks at the man. There is no fear in him. The men who attacked me, they were your friends? Raising an eyebrow. Nothing at all. How old are you? Older, the man guesses, than his emotional age. Touches of razored stubble at the corners of his upper lip, brown eyes clear and placid. The boy looks at the two empty plastic cups on the worn steel counter. He looks up at the man. Another? You wish to drink another? The boy nods. The man signals to the Italian behind the counter. He turns back to the boy. Do you have a name? Nothing. Nothing moves in the brown eyes. The boy regards him as calmly as might some placid dog. The silver pulping machine chugs briefly amid the stacked fruit. Shaved ice pours into the pulp. The Italian transfers the drink to a plastic cup and places it before the boy. The boy looks at it. The man shifts on the creaking metal stool, his long coat draped like resting wings. Beneath his arm, carefully cleaned now, the knife in its magnetic sheath swings free, sleeping. The boy raises the cup, opens his mouth, and pours the thick sludge of ice and fruit pulp down his throat. Defective, the man thinks, syndromes of the city's tragic womb, the signal of life distorted by chemicals, by starvation, by blows of fortune. Yet he, like everyone else, like the man himself, is exactly where, exactly what, exactly when he is meant to be. It is the Tao, darkness within darkness. The boy places the empty cup beside the other two. The man straightens his legs, stands, buttoning his coat. The boy reaches out. Two fingers touch the watch the man wears on his left wrist. He opens his mouth, as if to speak. The time? Something moves in the affectless brown depths of the boy's eyes. The watch is very old, purchased from a specialist dealer in a fortified arcade in Singapore. It is military ordnance. It speaks to the man of battles fought in another day. It reminds him that every battle will one day be as obscure, and that only the moment matters. Matters absolutely. The enlightened warrior rides into battle as if to a loved one's funeral, and how could it be otherwise? The boy leans forward now, the thing behind his eyes seeing only the watch. The man thinks of the two he leaves tonight on the bridge, hunters of sorts. Now they will hunt no more, and this one following them, to pick up scraps. You like this? Nothing registers. Nothing breaks the concentration, the link between that which has surfaced behind the boy's eyes and the austere black face of the watch. The Tao moves. The man unfastens the steel buckle that secures the strap. He hands the watch to the boy. He does this without thought. He does this with the same unthinking certainty with which, earlier, he killed. He does this because it fits, is fitting, because his life is alignment with the Tao. There is no need to say goodbye. He leaves the boy lost in contemplation of the black face, the hands. He leaves now, the moment in balance. 10. American Acropolis. Rydell managed to get part of the San Francisco grid on the Brazilian glasses coming in, but he still needed Creedmoor to tell him how to get to the garage where they were leaving the hawker Aichi. Creedmoor, when Rydell woke him for that, seemed uncertain as to who Rydell was, but did a fairly good job of covering it up. He did know, after consulting a folded business card he took from the watch pocket of his jeans, exactly where they should go. It was an old building, in the kind of area where buildings like that were usually converted to residential, but the frequency of razor wire suggested that this was not yet gentrified territory. There were a couple of universal square badges controlling entry, a firm that mostly did low-level industrial security. They were set up in an office by the gate, watching Reel One on a flat screen propped up on a big steel desk that looked like someone had gone over every square inch of it with a ball-peen hammer. Cups of takeout coffee and white foam food containers. It all felt kind of homey to Rydell, who figured they'd be going off shift soon, 7 in the morning. Wouldn't be a bad job, as bad jobs went. Delivering a drive away, Rydell told them. There was a deer on the flat screen. Behind it, the familiar shapes of the derelict skyscrapers of downtown Detroit. The Reel One logo in the lower right corner gave him the context. One of those nature shows. They gave him a pad to punch in the reservation number on Creedmoor's paper, and it came up paid. Had him sign on the pad, there. Told him to put it in slot 23, level 6. He left the office, got back into the hawker, swung up the ramp, wet tires squealing on concrete. Creedmoor was conducting a grooming operation in the illuminated mirror behind the passenger side sun visor. This consisted of running his fingers repeatedly back through his hair, wiping them on his jeans, then rubbing his eyes. He considered the results. "Time for a drink," he said to the reflection of his bloodshot eyes. 7 in the morning, Rydell said. "What I said," Creedmoor said, flipping the visor back up. Rydell found the number 23 painted on the concrete between two vehicles shrouded in white dust covers. He edged the hawker carefully in and started shutting it down. He was able to do this without having to go to the help menu. Creedmoor got out and went over to urinate on somebody's tire. Rydell checked the interior to see they hadn't left anything, undid the harness, leaned over to pull the passenger side door shut, popped the trunk, opened the driver's side door, checked that he had the keys, got out, closed the door. "Hey, Buell, your friend's going to pick this up, right?" Rydell was pulling his duffel out of the hawker Aichi's weirdly narrow trunk, a space suggestive of the interior of a child's coffin. There was nothing else in there, so he assumed Creedmoor was traveling without luggage. "No," Creedmoor said. "They gonna leave it up here, get all dusty." He was buttoning his fly. "So I give the keys to those Universal boys downstairs?" "No," Creedmoor said. "You give them to me." "I signed," Rydell said. "Give them to me." "Buell, this vehicle is my responsibility now. I've signed it in here." He closed the trunk, activated the security systems. "Please step back," said the hawker Aichi. "Respect my boundaries as I respect yours." It had a beautiful, strangely genderless voice, gentle but firm. Rydell took a step back. Another. "That's my friend's car and my friend's keys, and I'm supposed to give them to him." Creedmoor rested his hand on the big roper's buckle like it was the wheel of his personal ship of state, but he looked uncertain, as though his hangover were leaning on him. "Just tell him the keys will be here. That's how you do it. Safer all round that way." Rydell shouldered his bag and started down the ramp, glad to be stretching his legs. He looked back at Creedmoor. "See you around, Buell." "Son of a bitch," Creedmoor said. though Rydell took it to be more a reference to the universe that had created Rydell than to Rydell himself. Creedmoor looked lost and disconnected, squinting under the greenish-white strip lighting. Rydell kept walking, down the battered concrete spiral of the parking garage, 5 more levels, till he came abreast of the office at the entrance. The Universal Guards were drinking coffee, watching the end of their nature show. Now the deer moved through snow, snow that blew sideways, frosting the perfectly upright walls of Detroit's dead and monumental heart, vast black tines of brick reaching up to vanish in the white sky. They made a lot of nature shows there. He went out into the street looking for a cab or a place that made breakfast, smelling how San Francisco was a different place than Los Angeles, and feeling that was fine by him. He'd get something to eat, use the Brazilian glasses to phone Tokyo, find out about that money. 11. Other guy. Chevette had never driven a Standard, so it fell to Tessa to drive them up to San Francisco. Tessa didn't seem to mind. She had her head full of the docu they were going to make, and she could work it out as she drove, telling Chevette about the different communities she wanted to cover and how she was going to cut it all together. All Chevette had to do was listen, or look like she was listening, and finally just fall asleep. She fell asleep as Tessa was telling her about a place called the Walled City, how there had actually been this place by Hong Kong, but it had been torn down before Hong Kong went back to being part of China. And then these crazy net people had built their own version of it, like a big communal website, and they'd turned it inside out, vanished in there. It wasn't making much sense when Chevette nodded out, but it left pictures in her head, dreams. "What about the other guy?" Tessa was asking when Chevette woke from those dreams. Chevette blinked out at the 5, the white line that seemed to reel up beneath the van. "What other guy?"
"The cop. The one you went to Los Angeles with."
"Rydell," Chevette said.
"So why didn't that work?"
Tessa asked. Chevette didn't really have an answer. It just didn't.
"So you had to hook up with Casson?"
"No," Chevette said. "I didn't have to." What were those white things, so many of them, off in a field there? Wind things. They made electricity. It just seemed like a thing to do.
"I've done a few of those myself," Tessa said.
12. El Primero. Fontaine's first glimpse of the boy comes as he starts to lay out the morning's stock in his narrow display window, rough, dark hair above a forehead pressed against the armored glass. Fontaine leaves nothing of value in the window at night, but he dislikes the idea of an entirely empty display. He doesn't like to think of someone passing and glimpsing that vacancy. It makes him think of death. So each night, he leaves out a few items of relatively little value, ostensibly to indicate the nature of the shop's stock, but really as a private act of propitiatory magic. This morning, the window contains 3 inferior Swiss mechanicals, their dials flecked with age, an IXL double penknife with jigged bone handles and shield, fair condition, and an East German military field telephone that looks as though it had been designed not only to survive a nuclear explosion, but to function during one. Fontaine, still on the morning's first coffee, stares down through the glass at the matted, spiky hair, thinking this at first a corpse, and not the first he's discovered this way, but never propped thus, kneeling, as in an attitude of prayer. But no, this one lives. Breath fogs Fontaine's window. In Fontaine's left hand, a 1947 Courtebert triple-date moon-phase manual-wind gold-filled case, in very nearly the condition in which it left the factory. In his right, a warped red plastic cup of black Cuban coffee. The shop is filled with the smell of Fontaine's coffee, as burnt and acrid as he likes it. Condensation slowly pulses on the cold glass. Gray aureoles outline the kneeler's nostrils. Fontaine puts the Courtebert back in the tray with the rest of his better stock, narrow divisions of faded green velour holding a dozen watches. He sets the tray aside, on the counter, behind which he stands when he does business, transfers the red plastic cup to his left hand, and with his right reassures himself of the Smith & Wesson 32-22 kit gun in the right side pocket of the threadbare trench coat that serves him as a dressing gown. The little gun is there, older than some of his better watches, its worn walnut grip comforting and familiar, probably intended to be kept in a freshwater fisherman's tackle box against the dispatching of water snakes or the decapitation of empty beer bottles. The kit gun is Fontaine's considered choice, a six-shot rimfire revolver with a four-inch barrel. He doesn't want to kill anyone, Fontaine, though if truth be known, he has, and very probably could again. He dislikes recoil in a handgun, and excessive report, and distrusts semi-automatic weapons. He is an anachronist, a historian. He knows that the Smith & Wesson's frame evolved for a 32 caliber centerfire round, long extinct, that was once the standard for American pocket pistols. Rechambered for the homely 22, it survived, in this model, well into the middle of the 20th century. A handy thing, and, like most of his stock, a rarity. He finishes the coffee, places the empty cup on the counter beside the tray of watches. He is a good shot, Fontaine, at 12 paces, employing an archaic one-handed duelist's stance. He has been known to pick the pips from a playing card. He hesitates before unlocking the shop's front door, a complicated process. Perhaps the kneeler is not alone. Fontaine has few enemies on the bridge proper, but who is to say what might have drifted in from either end, San Francisco or Oakland? And the wilds of Treasure Island traditionally offer a more feral sort of crazy. But still, he throws the last hasp and draws the pistol. Sunlight falls through the bridge's wrapping of scrap wood and plastic like some strange venison. Fontaine scents the salt air, a source of corrosion.
"You!" he says. "Mister!"
The gun in his hand, hidden by the folds of the trench coat. Under the trench coat, which is beltless, open, Fontaine wears faded plaid flannel pajama bottoms and a long-sleeved white thermal undershirt rendered écru by the vagaries of the laundry process. Black shoes, sockless and unlaced, their gloss gone matte in the deeper creases. Dark eyes look up at him from a face that somehow refuses to come into focus.
"What you doing there?"
The boy cocks his head as if listening to something Fontaine cannot hear.
"Get away from my window!"
With a weird and utter lack of grace that strikes Fontaine as amounting to a species of grace in itself, this person gets to his feet. The brown eyes stare at Fontaine, but somehow do not see him, or do not recognize him, perhaps, as another being. Fontaine displays the Smith & Wesson, his finger on the trigger, but he does not quite point it at the boy. He never points a gun at anyone he is not yet entirely willing to shoot, a lesson learned long ago from his father. This kneeler, this breather on his glass, is not of the bridge. It would be difficult for Fontaine to explain how he knows this, but he does. It is a function of having lived here a long time. He doesn't know everyone on the bridge, nor would he want to, but he nonetheless distinguishes bridge dwellers from others, and with absolute certainty. This one now has something missing, something wrong. Not a state bespeaking drugs, but some more permanent mode of not being there. And while the population of the bridge possesses its share of these, they are somehow worked into the fabric of the place, and not inclined to appear thus, so randomly, as to disturb mercantile ritual. Somewhere high above, the bay wind whips a loose flap of plastic, a frenzied beating, like the idiot wing of some vast wounded bird. Fontaine, looking into brown eyes in the face that still refuses to come into focus, because, he thinks now, it is incapable, regrets having unlocked his door. Salt air even now gnaws at the bright metal vitals of his stock. He gestures with the barrel of his pistol. "Go." The boy extends his hand. A watch.
"What? You want to sell that?"
The brown eyes register no language. Fontaine, motivated by something he recognizes as compulsion, takes a step forward, his finger tightening on the pistol's double-action trigger. The chamber beneath the firing pin is empty for safety's sake, but a quick long pull will do the trick. Looks like stainless, black dial. Fontaine takes in the filthy black jeans, the frayed running shoes, the faded red T-shirt, hiked above a paunch that betrays the characteristic bloat of malnutrition. "You want to show that to me?" The boy looks down at the watch in his hand, then points to the three in the window. "Sure," Fontaine says. "We got watches. All kinds. You want to see?" Still pointing, the boy looks at him. "Come on," Fontaine says. "Come on in. Cold out here." Still holding the gun, though his finger has relaxed, he steps back into the shop. "You coming?" After a pause, the boy follows, holding the watch with the black dial as though it were a small animal. "Be nothing," Fontaine thinks. "Army wall fam with the guts rusted out. Bullshit. Bullshit he's let this freak in here." The boy stands staring in the center of the shop's tiny floor space. Fontaine closes the door, locks it once only, and retreats behind his counter, all this done without lowering the gun, getting within grabbing distance, or taking his eyes off his visitor. The boy's eyes widen as he sees the tray of watches. "First things first," Fontaine says, whisking the tray out of sight with his free hand. "Let's see," pointing at the watch in the boy's hand. "Here," Fontaine commands, tapping the faded gilt Rolex logo on a padded round of dark green leatherette. The boy seems to understand. He places the watch on the pad. Fontaine sees the black beneath the ragged nails as the hand withdraws. "Shit," Fontaine says, eyes acting up. "Back up there a minute," he says, gently indicating direction with the barrel of the Smith & Wesson. The boy takes a step back. Still watching the boy, he digs in the left side pocket of the trench coat and comes up with a black loop, which he screws into his left eye. "Don't you move now, okay? Don't want this gun to go off." Fontaine picks up the watch, affords himself a quick squint through the loop, whistles in spite of himself. "Jaeger LeCoultre." He unsquints, checking. The boy hasn't moved. Squints again, this time at the ordnance markings on the case back. "Royal Australian Air Force 1953, he translates. "Where'd you steal this?" "Nothing." "This is near mint." Fontaine feels all at once profoundly and unexpectedly lost. "This a redial?" "Nothing." Fontaine squints through the loop. "All original?" Fontaine wants this watch. He puts it down on the green pad atop the worn symbol of a golden crown, noting that the black calf band is custom-made, hand-sewn around bars permanently fixed between the lugs. This work itself, which he takes to be either Italian or Austrian, may have cost more than some of the watches in his tray. The boy immediately picks it up. Fontaine produces the tray. "Look here, you want to trade? Gruen Curvex here. Tudor London, 1948. Nice original dial. Vulcane cricket here, gold head. Very clean." But already he knows that his conscience will never allow him to divest this lost soul of this watch, and the knowledge hurts him. Fontaine has been trying all his life to cultivate dishonesty, what his father called sharp practices, and he invariably fails. The boy is leaning forward over the tray, Fontaine forgotten. "Here," Fontaine says, sliding the tray aside and replacing it with his battered notebook. He opens it to the pages where he shops for watches. "Just push this, then push this. It'll tell you what you're looking at." He demonstrates. A Jaeger with a silver face. Fontaine presses the second key. 1945 Jaeger chronometer, stainless steel, original dial, engraving on case back," says the notebook.
"Case,"
the boy says.
"Back."
"This," Fontaine shows the boy, the stainless back of a gold-filled Tissot tank. "But with writing on it, like, Joe Blow, 25 years with Blow Corp, congratulations." The boy looks blank, presses a key. Another watch appears on the screen. He presses the second key. A 1960 Vulcan jump hour chrome brassing at lugs dial very good.
Very good, Fontaine advises. Not good enough. See these spots here?
Indicating certain darker flecks scattered across the scan.
If it were very fine, sure.
Fine, says the boy, looking up at Fontaine. He presses the key that produces the image of another watch.
Let me see that watch, okay?
Fontaine points at the watch in the boy's hand.
It's okay, I'll give it back.
The boy looks from the watch to Fontaine. Fontaine puts the Smith & Wesson away in his pocket, shows the boy his empty hands.
I'll give it back.
The boy extends his hand. Fontaine takes the watch.
You gonna tell me where you got this?
Blank.
You want a cup of coffee?
Fontaine gestures back toward the simmering pot on the hot plate, smells its bitter brew thickening. The boy understands. He shakes his head. Fontaine screws the loop into his eye and settles into contemplation. Damn, he wants this watch. Later in the day, when the bento boy brings Fontaine his lunch, the Jaeger LeCoultre military is in the pocket of Fontaine's gray tweed slacks, high-waisted and extravagantly pleated. But Fontaine knows that the watch is not his. The boy has been put in the back of the shop, in that cluttered little zone that divides Fontaine's business from his private life, and Fontaine has become aware of the fact that he can, yes, smell his visitor. Under the morning's coffee smell, a definite and insistent reek of old sweat and unwashed clothes. As the bento boy exits to his box-stacked bicycle, Fontaine undoes the clips on his own box. Tempura today, not his favorite for bento, because it cools, but still he's hungry. Steam wafts from the bowl of miso as he unsnaps its plastic lid. He pauses.
Hey!
He says, back into the space behind the shop.
You want some miso?
No reply.
Soup! You hear me?
Fontaine sighs, climbs off his wooden stool, and carries the steaming bowl into the back of the shop. The boy is seated cross-legged on the floor, the notebook open on his lap. Fontaine sees the image of a large, very complicated chronometer floating there on the screen. Something from the 80s, by the look of it.
You want some miso?
Zenith, says the boy.
El primero. Stainless case. 31 jewels. 3019 PHC movement. Heavy stainless bracelet with flip lock. Original screw-down crown. Crown dial and movement signed.
Fontaine stares at him. 13. Second-hand daylight. Yamazaki returns with antibiotics, packaged foods, coffee in self-heating tins. He wears a black nylon flight jacket and carries these things along with his notebook in a blue mesh bag. He descends into the station through a crowd of only ordinary density well before the evening rush hour. He has found it difficult to sleep, his dreams haunted by the perfect face of Rei Toei, who is in a sense his employer, and who in another sense does not exist. She is a voice, a face, familiar to millions. She is a sea of code, the ultimate expression of entertainment software. Her audience knows that she does not walk among them, that she is media purely, and that is a large part of her appeal. If not for Rei Toei, Yamazaki considers, Lainey would not be here now. It was the attempt to understand her, to second-guess her motivation, that had originally brought Lainey to Tokyo. In the employ of Rez's management team, the singer Rez having declared his intention to marry her. And how, they asked, was that to be? How could any human, even one so thoroughly mediated, marry a construct, a congeries of software, a dream? And Rez, the Chinese-Irish singer, the pop star, had tried. Yamazaki knows this. He knows as much about this as any living human, including Rez, because Reitoe has discussed it with him. He understands that Rez exists as thoroughly in the realm of the digital as it is possible for a living human to exist. If Rez the man were to die today, Rez the icon would certainly live on. But Rez's yearning was to go there, literally to go where Reitoe is. Or was, she having now effectively vanished. The singer had sought to join her in some realm of the digital, or in some not yet imagined borderland, some intermediate state, and had failed. But has she gone there now? And why had Lainey fled as well? Rez tours the Combinat states now, insists on traveling by rail. Station to station, Moscow his goal, rumors of madness flickering in the band's wake. It is a dark business, Yamazaki thinks and wonders, taking the stairs to the cardboard city. What exactly Lainey is about here? Speaking of nodal points in history, of some emerging pattern in the texture of things, of everything changing. Lainey is a sport, a mutant, the accidental product of covert clinical trials of a drug that induced something oddly akin to psychic abilities in a small percentage of test subjects. But Lainey isn't psychic in any non-rational sense. Rather, he is able, through the organic changes wrought long ago by 5SB, this drug, to somehow perceive change emerging from vast flows of data. And now Reitoe is gone, her management claims. And how can that be? Yamazaki suspects that Lainey may know why or where, and that is a factor in Yamazaki's having decided to return here and find him. He has been extremely careful to avoid being followed, but he also knows that that can mean next to nothing. The smell of the Tokyo subway, familiar as the smell of his mother's apartment, comforts him now. It is a smell at once utterly distinctive and impossible to describe. It is the smell of Japanese humanity, of which he very much feels himself a part, as manifested in this singular environment, this world of tubes, of white corridors, of whispering silver trains. He finds the passageway between the two escalators, the tiled columns. He half suspects that the shelters will be gone. But they are here, and when he dons a white micropore mask and enters the model builder's brightly lit hutch, nothing has changed, except the kit the old man concentrates on now, a multi-headed dinosaur with robotic hind limbs in navy and silver. The brush tip works in the eye of one reptilian head. The old man does not look up. Lainey? Nothing from behind the square of melon-yellow blanket. Yamazaki nods to the old man and crawls past on hands and knees, pushing his mesh bag of supplies before him. Lainey? Hush, Lainey says from the narrow, fetid dark. He's talking. Who is talking? Pushing the bag past the limp, foam-filled fabric, its touch on his face reminding him of nursery school. As Yamazaki enters, Lainey activates a projector in the clumsy iPhones. The images he sees splay across Yamazaki, blinding him. Yamazaki twists to avoid the beam, sees figures framed in second-hand daylight. Imagine he does that on a regular basis, handheld but digitally stabilized. Something to do with phases of the moon? Zooms in on one of the figures, lean and male, as all are, mouth obscured by a dark scarf, stiff black hair above a high white forehead. No evidence of that. Opportunistic. He waits for them to come to him. Then he takes them. These, and the camera swings smoothly to frame the face and bare chest of a dead man, eyes staring, are Jackers. This one had Dancer in his pocket. There is a dark comma on the dead man's pale chest, just below the sternum. The other one was stabbed through the throat, but somehow he managed to miss the arteries. He would, says the unseen man. We have profiles, the man with the scarf says off-camera, the face of the corpse thrown across Laney's cardboard wall, the melon blanket. We have a full forensic psych run-up, but you ignore them. Of course I do. You're in denial. Two pairs of hands in latex gloves grasp the dead man, flip him over. There is a second, smaller wound visible beneath one shoulder blade. Blood has pooled within the body, darkened. He poses as real a danger to you as to anyone else. But he's interesting, isn't he? The wound, in close-up, is a small, unsmiling mouth. The blood reads black. Not to me. But you aren't interesting, are you? No. And the camera pans up, light catching a sharp cheekbone above the black scarf. And you don't want me to be, do you? There is a faint chime as the transmission is terminated. Laney throws back his head, the image of the man with the scarf in freeze frame across the ceiling of the carton, too bright, distorted, and Yamazaki sees that the cardboard there is shingled with tiny self-adhesive printouts, dozens of different images of a bland-looking man, oddly familiar. Yamazaki blinks, his contacts shifting, and misses his glasses. He feels incomplete without them.
Who was that man, Laney?
The help, Laney says.
Help?
Hard to get good help these days. Laney kills the projector and removes the massive iPhones. In the sudden gloom, his face is reduced to a child's drawing, smudged black eye holes against a pallid smear.
The man who was taking that call... The one who spoke?
He owns the world, near as anyone does. Yamazaki frowns.
I have brought medicine.
That was from the bridge, Yamazaki.
San Francisco?
They followed my other man there. They followed him last night, but they lost him. They always do. This morning they found those bodies.
Followed who?
The man who isn't there. The one I'm having to infer.
These are pictures of Harwood? Of Harwood Levine?
Yamazaki has recognized the face replicated on the stickers.
Spooks are his.
Best money can buy, probably, but they can't get close to the man who isn't there.
What man?
I think he's someone Harwood collected. Collects people. Interesting people. I think he might have worked for Harwood, taken commissions. He doesn't leave a trace, none at all. When he crosses someone's path, they're just gone. Then he erases himself.
Yamazaki fumbles the antibiotics from his bag.
Will you take these, Laney? Your cough...
Where's Rydell, Yamazaki? He's supposed to be up there now.
It's all coming together. What is?
I don't know, Laney says, leaning forward to dig through the contents of the bag. He finds a coffee and activates it, tossing it from hand to hand as it heats. Yamazaki hears the pop, the vacuum hiss, as Laney opens it. Smell of coffee. Laney sips from the steaming can.
Something's happening,
Laney says and coughs into his hand. Slopping hot creamed coffee on Yamazaki's wrist, Yamazaki flinches.
Everything's changing. Or it's not really. How I see it is changing. But since I've been able to see it the new way, something else has started. There's something building up. Big. Bigger than big. It'll happen soon. Then there'll be a cascade effect. What will happen? I don't know.
Another fit of coughing requires that he set aside the coffee. Yamazaki has opened the antibiotics and tries to offer them. Laney waves them aside.
Have you been back to the island? Do they have any idea where she is?
Yamazaki blinks.
No. She is simply not present.
Laney smiles, faint gleam of teeth against the darkness of his mouth.
That's good. She's in it too, Yamazaki.
He reaches for the coffee.
She's in it too.
14. Breakfast. Cooking. Rydell found a place in one of those buildings that had clearly been a bank when banks had needed to have buildings. Thick walls. Someone had turned it into an all-day breakfast special place, and that was what Rydell was after. Actually, it looked like it had been some kind of discount store before that, and who knew what else before. But it had that eggs and grease smell, and he was hungry. There were a couple of size-large construction types covered with white drywall dust waiting for a table, but Rydell saw that the counter was empty, so he went over there and took a stool. The waitress was a distracted-looking woman of indeterminate ancestry, acne scar sprinkled across her cheekbones, and she poured his coffee and took his order without actually indicating she understood English. Like the whole operation could be basically phonetic, he thought, and she'd have learned the sound of two eggs over easy and the rest. Hear it, translate it into whatever she wrote in, then give it to the cook. Rydell got the Brazilian glasses out, put them on, and scrolled for the number Yamazaki had given him in Tokyo. Someone picked up on the third ring, but the glasses didn't map a location for the answering phone. Probably meant another mobile. Silence on the line, but it had a texture. Hey, Rydell said. Yamazaki? Rydell? Laney. Cut off by a burst of coughing and then dead silence as someone hit mute. When Laney came back on, he sounded strangled.
Sorry. Where are you?
San Francisco, Rydell said.
I know that,
Laney said. In the diner on... Rydell was scrolling the GPS menu trying to get in, but he kept getting what looked like Rio transit maps.
Never mind,
Laney said. Sounded tired. What time would it be in Tokyo? That would be in the phone menu if he could find it.
What matters is you're there.
Yamazaki said you had something for me to do up here.
I do,
said Laney. And Rydell remembered his cousin's wedding, Clarence having sounded just about as happy saying that. You want to tell me what it is?
No, said Laney, but I want to put you on retainer. Money up front for as long as you're up there.
Is it legal, Laney, what you want done? There was a pause.
I don't know,
Laney said.
Some of it hasn't ever been done before, probably, so it's hard to say.
Well, I think I need to know a little more than that before I can take it on, Rydell said, wondering how the hell he'd ever get back down to Los Angeles if this didn't pan out, or indeed if there was any point in his going back.
You could say it's a missing person, Laney said after another pause.
Name?
Doesn't have one.
Probably has a few thousand more like it.
Listen, you like cop stuff, right?
What's that supposed to mean?
No offense, you told me cop stories when I met you, remember? Okay, so this person I'm looking for is very, very good at not leaving traces. Nothing ever turns up. Not in the deepest quantitative analysis.
Laney met net search stuff. That was what he did.
He's just a physical presence.
How do you know he's a physical presence if he doesn't leave traces?
Because people die, Laney said.
And just then there were people taking seats on either side of him and a sharp reek of vodka. Get back to you, Rydell said, thumbing the pad and pulling the glasses off. Creedmore grinning on his left.
Howdy, said Creedmore. This here's Mary Jane.
Mary Alice.
On the stool to Rydell's right, a big old blonde with most of the top of her strapped up into something black and shiny, the unstrapped part forming a cleavage where Creedmore could easily have wedged one of those pint bottles. Rydell caught something deep in her tired eyes, some combination of fear, resignation, and a kind of blind and automatic hope. She was not having a good morning, year, or life, probably. But there was something there that wanted him to like her. Whatever it was, it stopped Rydell from getting up with his bag and walking out, which was really what he knew he should be doing.
Ain't you gonna say hi?
Creedmore's breath was toxic. Hey, Mary Alice,
Rydell said. "Name's Rydell. Pleased to meet you." Mary Alice smiled about a decade's wear lifting just for a second from her eyes.
"Buell here tells me you're from Los Angeles, Mr. Rydell."
"Does he?" Rydell looked at Creedmoor.
"Are you in the media down there, Mr. Rydell?" she asked.
"No," Rydell said, fixing Creedmoor with the hardest look he could muster. "Retail."
"I'm in the music business myself," Mary Alice said. "My ex and I operated one of the most successful country music venues in Tokyo. But I felt the need to get back to my roots. To God's country, Mr. Rydell."
"You talk too much," said Creedmoor
across Rydell as the waitress brought Rydell's breakfast.
"Buell,"
Rydell said with something approximating a tone of even good cheer, "shut the fuck up." Rydell started cutting the hardened edges off his eggs.
"Bear me,"
Buell said.
"Oh, Buell,"
Mary Alice said. She hauled a big plastic zip bag up off the floor, some kind of advertising giveaway, and rummaged inside. Came up with a tall, sweaty can of something she passed to Creedmoor, over Rydell's lap, under the counter. Creedmoor popped it, held it to his ear as if admiring the hiss of carbonation.
"Sound of breakfast cooking," he said, then drank.
Rydell sat there, chewing his leathery eggs.
"So you go to this site," Laney was saying. "Give them my name. Colin, space, Laney, cap C, cap L, first four digits of this phone number, and Barry. That's your nickname, right?"
"Actually, it's my name," Rydell said. "Family name on my mother's side."
He was seated in a capacious but none too clean cubicle in the former bank's restroom. He'd gone there to get away from Creedmoor and company, and so he could ring Laney back.
"So I give them that. What'll they give me?"
Rydell looked up at his bag where he'd hung it on the sturdy chrome hook on the cubicle door. He hadn't wanted to leave it out in the restaurant.
"They'll give you another number. You take that to any banking machine, show it picture ID, key the number. It'll issue you a credit chip. Should be enough to hold you for a few days, but if it's not, phone me."
Something about being in there made Rydell feel like he was in one of those old-fashioned submarine movies, the part where they shut off the engines and wait, really quiet, for the depth charges they know are on the way. It was that quiet in here, probably because the bank was so solidly built. The only sound was the running of the toilet tank, which he thought added to the illusion.
"Okay,"
Rydell said.
"Assuming all that works, who is it you're looking for? And what was that you said about people dying?"
"European male, mid to late 50s. Probably has a military background, but that was a long time ago."
"That narrows it to maybe a million probables up here in NoCal alone."
"How this is going to work, Rydell, is he'll find you. I'll tell you where to go and what to ask for, and one thing and another will bring you to his attention."
"Sounds too easy."
"Coming to his attention will be easy. Staying alive once you do will not be."
Rydell considered.
"So what am I supposed to do for you when he finds me?"
"Ask him a question."
"What question?"
"I don't know yet," Laney said. "I'm working on it."
"Laney,"
Rydell said,
"what's this all about?"
"If I knew that,"
Laney said, and suddenly he sounded very tired,
"I wouldn't have to be here."
He fell silent, clicked off.
"Laney?"
Rydell sat listening to the toilet run. Eventually he got up, took his bag down from the hook, and exited the cubicle. He washed his hands in a trickle of cold water that ran into a black imitation marble sink, crusted with yellowish industrial soap, and made his way back along a corridor made narrow by cartons of what he took to be janitorial supplies. He hoped that Creedmoor and the country music mama would have forgotten about him, gone away. Not so. The woman was working on her own plate of eggs, while Creedmoor, his beer clipped between his denim thighs, was staring balefully at the two enormous gypsum-dusted construction workers.
"Hey,"
Creedmoor said as Rydell walked past carrying his bag. "Hey," Buell said, heading for the door to the street.
"Hey, where are you going?"
"To work," Rydell said.
"Work?"
he heard Creedmoor say, and
"shit!"
But the door swung shut behind him, and he was on the street. 15. Back up here. Chivette stood beside the man watching Tessa release God's little toy. The camera platform, like a Mylar muffin or an inflated coin, caught the day's watery light as it rose, wobbling, then leveled out, swaying at 15 feet or so. Chivette felt very strange being here, seeing this. The concrete tank traps, beyond them the impossible shape of the bridge itself. Where she had lived, though it now seemed a dream, or someone else's life, atop the nearest cable tower. Way up in a cube of plywood there, sleeping while the wind's great hands shoved and twisted and clawed, and she'd heard the tendons of the bridge groan, all in secret. A sound carried up the twisted strands, for only her to hear. Chivette, with her ear pressed against the graceful dolphin back of cable that rose through the oval hole sliced for it through Skinner's plywood floor. Now Skinner was dead, she knew. He'd gone while she was in Los Angeles, trying to become whoever it was she'd thought she wanted to be. She hadn't come up. The bridge people weren't big on funerals, and possession here was most points of the law. She wasn't Skinner's daughter, and even if she had been, and had wanted to hold his place atop the cable tower, it would have been a matter of staying there for as long as she intended it to be hers. She hadn't wanted that. But she'd had no way to grieve him in Los Angeles. And now it all came up, came back, the time she'd lived with him. How he had found her too sick to walk and taken her home, feeding her soups he bought from the Korean vendors, until she was well. Then he'd left her alone, asking nothing, accepting her there the way you'd accept a bird on a windowsill, until she'd learned to ride a bicycle in the city and become a messenger. And soon the roles had reversed, the old man failing, needing help, and she the one to go for soup, bring water, see that coffee was made. And that was how it had been, until she'd gotten herself into the trouble that had resulted in her first having met Rydell. "Wind'll catch that," she cautioned Tessa, who had put on the glasses that let her watch the feed from the floating camera.
"I've got 3 more in the car,"
Tessa said, pulling a sleazy-looking black control glove over her right hand. She experimented with the touchpads, revving the platform's miniature props and swinging it through a 20-foot circle. "We've got to hire someone to watch the van," Chivette said, "if you want to see it again."
"Hire someone? Who?"
Chivette pointed to a thin black child with dusty dreadlocks to his waist.
"You. What's your name?" "What's it to you?"
"Pay you watch this van. We come back, ship you 50. Fair?" The boy regarded her evenly.
"Name Boomzilla,"
he said. "Boomzilla," Chivette said. "You take care of this van?"
"Deal,"
he said.
"Deal,"
Chivette said to Tessa.
"Lady,"
Boomzilla said, pointing up at God's little toy,
"I want that."
"Stick around," Tessa said.
"We'll need a grip."
Tessa touching fingers to black padded palm, the camera platform executing a second turn and gliding out of sight above the tank traps. Tessa smiling, seeing what it saw.
"Come on,"
she said to Chivette and stepped between the nearest traps.
"Not that way," Chivette said. "Over here."
There was a path you followed if you were just walking through. To take another route indicated either ignorance or the desire to do business. She showed Tessa the way. It stank of urine between the concrete slabs. Chivette walked more quickly, Tessa behind her, and emerged again into that wet light. But here it ran not across the stalls and vendors of memory, but across the red and white front of a modular convenience store, chunked down front and center across the entrance to the bridge's 2 levels. Lucky Dragon, and the shutter of video up the trademark tower of screens.
"Fucking hell," said Tessa. "How interstitial is that?"
Chivette stopped, stunned.
"How could they do that?"
"It's what they do,"
Tessa said. "Prime location.
but it's like Nissan County or something. Gated attraction. The community's a tourist draw, right?
Lots of people won't go where there's no police.
Autonomous zones are their own draw, Tessa said. This one's been here long enough to become the city's number one postcat.
God-awful, Chevette said. It ruins it.
Who do you think Lucky Dragon Corp is paying rent to?
Tessa asked, swinging the platform around for a pan across the store. No idea, Chevette said. It's right in the middle of what used to be the street.
Never mind, Tessa said, moving on into the pedestrian traffic flowing to and from the bridge. We're just in time. We're going to document the life before it's theme-packed.
Chevette followed, not knowing what it was exactly that she felt. They ate lunch in a Mexican place called Dirty Is God. Chevette didn't remember it from before, but places changed names on the bridge. They changed size and shape, too. You'd get these strange mergers, a hair place and an oyster bar deciding to become a bigger place that cut hair and sold oysters. Sometimes it worked. One of the longest-running places on the San Francisco end was an old-style manual tattoo parlor that served breakfast. You could sit there over a plate of eggs and bacon and watch somebody get needled with some kind of hand-drawn flash. But Dirty Is God was just Mexican food and Japanese music, a pretty straightforward proposition. Tessa got the huevos rancheros, and Chevette got a chicken quesadilla. They both had a Corona, and Tessa parked the camera platform up near the tented plastic ceiling. Nobody noticed it up there, apparently, so Tessa could do documentary while she ate. Tessa ate a lot. She said it was her metabolism, one of those people who never gains any weight regardless of how much she ate, but she needed to do it to keep her energy up. Tessa put away her huevos before Chevette was halfway through her quesadilla. She drained her glass bottle of Corona and started fiddling with a wedge of lime, squeezing it, working it into the neck.
Casson, Tessa said. You worried about him?
What about him?
He's an abusive ex, is what about him. That was his car back in Malibu, wasn't it?
I think so, Chevette said.
You think so? You aren't sure?
Look, Chevette said. It was early in the morning. It was all pretty strange.
It wasn't my idea to come up here, you know. It was your idea. You want to make your movie.
The lime popped down into the empty Corona bottle, and Tessa looked at it as though she'd just lost a private wager.
You know what I like about you? I mean, one of the things I like about you.
What? Chevette asked.
You aren't middle class. You just aren't. You move in with this guy. He starts hitting you. What do?
Move out.
That's right. You move out. You don't take a meeting with your lawyers.
I don't have any lawyers, Chevette said.
I know, that's what I mean.
I don't like lawyers, Chevette said.
Of course you don't, and you don't have any reflex to litigation.
Litigation?
He beat you up. He's got 800 square feet of strata title loft. He's got a job. He beats you up. You don't automatically order a surgical strike. You're not middle class.
I just don't want anything to do with him.
That's what I mean. You're from Oregon, right?
More or less, Chevette said.
You ever think of acting?
Tessa inverted the bottle. The squashed lime wedge fell down into the neck. A few drops of beer fell on the scratched black plastic of the table. Tessa inserted the little finger of her right hand and tried to snag the lime wedge.
No. Camera loves you. You've got a body makes boys chew cap it.
Get off, Chevette said.
Why do you think they were putting those party shots of you up on the website back in Malibu?
Because they were drunk, Chevette said. Because they don't have anything better to do. Because they're media students. Tessa hooked the lime wedge, what was left of it, out of the bottle.
Right on all three, she says. But the main reason's your looks.
Behind Tessa, on one of Dirty as God's recycled wall screens, a very beautiful Japanese girl had appeared. Look at her, Chevette said. That's looks, right? Tessa looked over her shoulder.
That's Reitoe, she said.
So she's beautiful. She is.
Chevette, Tessa said. She doesn't exist. There's no live girl there at all. She's code. Software.
No way, Chevette said.
You didn't know that?
But she's based on somebody, right? Some kind of motion capture deal?
Nobody, Tessa said. Nothing. She's the real deal. 100% unreal.
Then that's what people want, Chevette said, watching Ray Toe swan through some kind of retro-Asian nightclub. Not ex-bicycle messengers from San Francisco.
No, Tessa said. You've got it exactly backwards. People don't know what they want, not before they say it. Every object of desire is a found object. Traditionally, anyway.
Chevette looked at Tessa across the two empty Corona bottles. What are you getting at, Tessa?
The documentary. It has to be about you.
Forget it.
No. I've got vision thing working big time on this. I need you for the focus. I need narrative traction. I need Chevette Washington.
Chevette was actually starting to feel a little scared. It made her angry. Don't you have a grant to do this one particular project you've been talking about? These interstitial things?
Look, Tessa said, if that's a problem, and I'm not saying it is, it's my problem. And it's not a problem, it's an opportunity. It's a shot. My shot.
Tessa, there is no way you are going to get me to act in your movie. None. You understand?
Acting isn't in it, Chevette. All you have to do is be yourself. And that will involve finding out who you really are. I am going to make a film about you finding out who you really are.
You are not, said Chevette, getting up and actually bumping into the camera platform, which must have descended to level with her head while they were talking.
Stop that!
Swatting at God's little toy. The other four customers in Dirty as God, just looking at them. 16. Subroutines. That hole at the core of Lainey's being, that underlying absence, he begins to suspect, is not so much an absence in the self as of the self. Something has happened to him since his descent into the cardboard city. He has started to see that previously he had, in some unthinkably literal way, no self. But what was there, he wonders, before? Subroutines. Maladaptive survival behaviors desperately conspiring to approximate a presence that would be, and never quite be, Lainey. And he has never known this before, although he knows that he has always somehow been aware of something, having been desperately and utterly wrong. Something tells him this. Something in the core and totality, it seems, of Date America. How can that be? But now he lies, propped in sleeping bags, in darkness, as if at the earth's core, and beyond cardboard walls are walls of concrete, sheathed in ceramic tile, and beyond them the footing of this country, Japan, with the shudder of the trains a reminder of tectonic forces, the shifting of continent-wide plates. Somewhere within Lainey, something else is shifting. There is movement, and potential for greater movement still, and he wonders why he is no longer afraid. And all of this is somehow a gift of the sickness, not of the cough, the fever, but of that underlying dis-ease that he takes to be the product of 5SB he ingested so long ago in the orphanage in Gainesville. We were all volunteers, he thinks, as he clutches the iPhones and follows his point of view over the edge of a cliff of data, plunging down the wall of this code mesa, its face compounded of fractally differentiated fields of information, he has come to suspect of hiding some power or intelligence beyond his comprehension. Something at once noun and verb. While Lainey, plunging, eyes wide against the pressure of information, knows himself to be merely adjectival, a Lainey-colored smear, meaningless without context, a microscopic cog
in some catastrophic plan, but positioned, he senses, centrally, crucially. And that is why sleep is no longer an option. 17. Zodiac. They take Silencio, naked, the black man with the long face and the fat white man with a red beard, into a room with wet wooden walls. Leave him. Hot rain falls from holes in the black plastic pipes above, falls harder, stings. They have taken his clothes and shoes away in a plastic bag. And now the fat man returns, gives him soap. He knows soap. He remembers the warm rain falling from a pipe in Los Proyectos. But this is better, and he is alone in the tall wooden room. Silencio, with his belly full, soaping himself repeatedly, because that is what they want. He rubs the soap into his hair. He closes his eyes against the burning of the soap and sees the watches arrayed beneath greenish, randomly abraded glass, like fish from some warmer season, frozen hard in lake ice, bright highlights off steel and gold. He has been colonized by an order uncomprehended, the multifold fact of these potent objects, their endless differentiation, their individual specificities. Infinite variety arising from the expression of dial, hands, numerals, hour markers. He likes the warm rain, but he needs desperately to return, to see more, to hear the words. He has become the words, what they mean. Breguet hands, tapestry dial, Bombay lugs, original stem, signed. The rain slows, stops. The fat man who wears plastic sandals brings Silencio a thick, dry cloth. The fat man peers at him. Watches, you say he likes? The fat man asks the black man. Yes, the black man says. He seems to like watches. The bearded man drapes the towel around Silencio's shoulders. Does he know how to tell time? I don't know, says the black man. Well, says the fat man, stepping back. He doesn't know how to use a towel. Silencio feels confused, ashamed. He looks down. Leave him alone, Andy, the black man says. Give me those clothes I brought. The black man's name? Fontaine. Like a word in the language of Los Proyectos, meaning about water. The warm rain in the wooden room. Now Fontaine leads him through the upper level, where some people call out, selling fruit, past others selling old things spread on blankets, to where a thin, dark man stands waiting beside a plastic crate. The crate is upturned, its bottom padded with foam and ragged silver tape, and this man wears a striped cloth thing with pockets down his front, and in the pockets are scissors, and things like the thing Raton liked to run endlessly through his hair, when he had balanced the black perfectly with the white. Silencio is wearing the clothes Fontaine has given him. They are large, loose, not his own, but they smell good. Fontaine has given him shoes made of white cloth. Too white, they hurt his eyes. The soap and the warm rain have made Silencio's hair strange as well, and now Fontaine tells Silencio to sit upon the crate. This man will cut his hair. Silencio sits, trembling, as the thin, dark man flicks at his hair with one of the raton things from his pockets, making small noises behind his teeth. Silencio looks at Fontaine. It's okay, Fontaine says, unwrapping a small, sharp stick of wood and inserting it into the corner of his mouth. You won't feel a thing. Silencio wonders if the stick is like the black or the white, but Fontaine does not change. He stands there with the stick in his mouth, watching the thin, dark man snip away Silencio's hair with the scissors. Silencio watches Fontaine, listens to the sound of the scissors, and to the new language in his head. Zodiac Seawolf, case very clean, screw-down crown, original bezel. Zodiac Seawolf, Silencio says. Man, says the thin, dark man. You deep. 18. Selwyn Tong. Rydell had a theory about virtual real estate. The smaller and cheaper the physical site of a given operation, the bigger and cheesier the website. According to this theory, Selwyn F.X. Tong, Notary Public of Kowloon, was probably operating out of a rolled-up newspaper. Rydell couldn't figure out a way to skip the approach segment, which was monolithic, vaguely Egyptian, and reminded him of what his buddy Sublet, a film buff, had called corridor metaphysics. This was one long-ass corridor, and if it had been physical, you could have driven a very large truck down it. There were Baroque sconce lights, virtual scarlet wall-to-wall, and weird tacky texture mapping that tended to gold-flecked marble. Where had Laney found this guy? Eventually, Rydell did manage to kill the music, something vaguely classical and swelling, but it still seemed to take him 3 minutes to get to Selwyn F.X. Tong's doors, which were tall, very tall, and mapped to resemble some generic idea of tropical hardwood. "Teak my ass," said Rydell.
"Welcome," said a breathless, hyper-feminine voice, "to the offices of Selwyn F.X. Tong, Notary Public."
The door swung open. Rydell figured that if he hadn't killed the music, it would be peaking about now. Virtually, the notary's office was about the size of an Olympic pool, but scarce on detail. Rydell used the rocker pad on his glasses to scoot his POV right up to the desk, which was about the size of a pool table, and mapped in that same ramped-down wood look. There were a couple of nondescript metallic-looking objects on it, and a few pieces of virtual paper.
"What's the FX stand for?" Rydell asked.
"Francis Xavier," said Tong,
who presented as a sort of deadpan cartoon of a small Chinese man in a white shirt, black tie, black suit. His black hair and the black suit were mapped in the same texture, a weird effect, and one Rydell took to be unintentional.
"I thought you might be in video," Rydell said. "Like it's a nickname? FX Effects, right?"
"I am Catholic," Tong said, his tone neutral.
"No offense," Rydell said.
"None taken,"
said Tong, his plastic-looking face as shiny as his plastic-looking eyes. You always forgot, Rydell reflected, just how bad this stuff could look if it hadn't been handled right.
"What can I do for you, Mr. Rydell?"
"Laney didn't tell you?"
"Laney?"
"Colin," Rydell said. "Space Laney."
"And?"
6, Rydell said. 042.
Tong's plastic-looking eyes narrowed.
"Barry."
Tong pursed his lips. Behind him, through a broad window at a different rate of resolution, Rydell could see the skyline of Hong Kong.
"Barry," Rydell repeated. "Thank you, Mr. Rydell,"
the notary said.
"My client has authorized me to give you this 7-digit identification number."
A gold fountain pen appeared in Tong's right hand, like a continuity error in a student film. It was a very large pen, elaborately mapped with swirling dragons, their scales in higher resolution than anything else in the sight. Probably a gift, Rydell decided. Tong wrote the 7 digits on one of the sheets of virtual paper, then reversed it on the desktop so that Rydell could read it. The pen had vanished as unnaturally as it had appeared.
"Please don't repeat this number aloud," Tong said.
"Why not?"
"Issues of encryption,"
Tong said obscurely.
"You have as long as you like to memorize the number."
Rydell looked at the 7 digits and began to work out a mnemonic. He finally arrived at one based on his birthday, the number of states when he was born, his father's age when he died, and a mental image of 2 cans of 7-Up. When he was certain that he'd be able to recall the number, he looked up at Tong.
"Where do I go to get the credit chip?" "Any automated teller. You have photo identification?"
"Yes," Rydell said.
"Then we are finished."
"One thing," Rydell said.
"What is that?"
"Tell me how I get out of here without having to go back down that corridor of yours. I just want a straight exit, right?"
Tong regarded him blandly.
Click on my face.
Rydell did, using the rocker pad to summon a cursor shaped like a neon green cartoon hand, pointing. Thanks, he said, as Tong's office folded. He was in the corridor, facing back the way he had come.
Damn,
Rydell said. The music began. He worked the rocker pad, trying to remember how he'd killed it before. He wanted to get a GPS fix on the nearest ATM, though, so he didn't unplug the glasses. He clicked for the end of the corridor. The click seemed to trigger a metastatic surge of bit rot, every bland texture map rewritten in some weirder hand. The red carpet went gray-green, its nap grown strange and unevenly furry, like something at the bottom of a month-old cup of coffee, while the walls went from whorehouse marble to a moist fish-belly pallor, the sconce lights glowing dim as drowned corpse candles. Tong's fake classical theme cracked and hollowed, weird bass notes rumbling in just above the threshold of the subsonic. It all took about a second to happen, and it took Rydell maybe another second to get the idea that someone wanted his undivided attention.
Rydell.
It was one of those voices that they fake up from found audio. Speech cobbled from wind down skyscraper canyons. The creaking of Great Lakes ice. Tree frogs clanging in the southern night. Rydell had heard them before. They grated on the nerves, as they were meant to, and conveniently disguised the voice of the speaker, assuming the speaker had a voice in the first place. Hey, Rydell said. I was just trying to click out. A virtual screen appeared in front of him, a round-cornered rectangle whose dimensions were meant to invoke the cultural paradigm of 20th-century video screens. On it, an oddly angled, monochromatic view of some vast, shadowy space, dimly lit from above. Nothing there. Impression of decay. Great age.
I have important information for you.
The vowel in you suggested a siren dopplering past, then gone. Well, said Rydell, if your middle name is FX, you're sure going to some trouble. There was a pause, Rydell staring at the dead blank space depicted or recorded on the screen. He was waiting for something to move there. Probably that was the point of it, but nothing did.
You'd better take this information very seriously, Mr. Rydell.
I'm serious as cancer, Rydell said. Shoot!
Use the ATM at the Lucky Dragon near the entrance to the bridge. Then present your identification at the Globe X franchise at the rear of the store.
Why?
They're holding something for you.
Tong, Rydell said, is that you? But there was no answer. The screen vanished, and the corridor was as it had been. Rydell reached up and disconnected the rented cable from the Brazilian glasses. Blinked. A coffee place near Union Square, the kind that had potted plants and hot desks. An early office crowd was starting to line up for sandwiches. He got up, folded the glasses, tucked them into the inside pocket of his jacket, and picked up his bag. 19. Interstitial. Chevette moves past the colorless flame of a chestnut vendor's charcoal fire, powdery gray burning itself down in the inverted V-nosed hood of some ancient car. She sees another fire, in memory. Coke glow of a smith's forge, driven by the exhaust of a vacuum cleaner. Beside her, the old man held the drive chain of some extinct motorcycle, folded neatly into a compact mass, and fastened with a twist of rusty wire, to be taken in the smith's tongs and placed within the forge, to be beaten, finally, incandescent, into a billet of their strangely grained Damascus, ghosts of those links emerging as the blade is forged, quenched, shaped,
and polished on the wheel. Where did that knife go, she wonders. She'd watched the maker craft and braze a hilt of brass, rivet slabs of laminated circuit board, and shape them on a belt grinder. The rigid, brittle-looking board, layers of fabric trapped in green phenolic resin, was everywhere on the bridge, a common currency of landfills. Each sheet mapped with dull metallic patterns suggesting cities, streets. When they came from the scavengers, they were studded with components, easily stripped with a torch, melting the gray solder. The components fell away, leaving the singed green boards with their inlaid foil maps of imaginary cities, residue of the second age of electronics. And Skinner would tell her that these boards were immortal, inert as stone, proof against moisture and ultraviolet and every form of decay. That they were destined to litter the planet, hence it was good to reuse them. Work them, when possible, into the fabric of things, a resource when something needed to be durable. She knows she needs to be alone now, so she's left Tessa on the lower level, collecting visual texture with God's little toy. Chevette can't hear any more about how Tessa's film has to be more personal about her, Chevette, and Tessa hasn't been able to shut up about that, or take no for an answer. Chevette remembers Bunny Malatesta, her dispatcher, when she rode here, how he'd say, "And what part of no is it that you don't understand?" But Bunny could deliver lines like that as though he were a force of nature, and Chevette knows she can't, that she lacks Bunny's gravity, the sheer crunch required to get it across. So she's taken an escalator, one she doesn't remember, to the upper level, and is making her way without really thinking about it, to the foot of their tower, the wet light having turned to a thin and gusting rain, blowing through the bridge's tattered second-hand superstructure. People are hauling their laundry in where they've hung it, draped on lines, and there's a general pre-storm bustle that she knows will fade if the weather changes. And so far, she thinks, she's not seen a single face she knows from before, and no one has greeted her, and she finds herself imagining the bridge's entire population replaced in her absence. No, there went the bookstall woman, the one with the ivory chopsticks thrust into her dyed black bun. And she recognizes the Korean boy with the bad leg, rumbling his father's soup wagon along as though it should have brakes. The tower she descended each day to Skinner's plywood shack is bundled in subsidiary construction, its iron buried at the core of an organic complex of spaces appropriated for specific activities. Behind taut, wind-shivered sheets of milky plastic, the unearthly light of a hydroponics operation casts outsized leaf shadows. She hears the snarl of an electric saw from the tiny workshop of a furniture maker, whose assistant sits patiently rubbing wax into a small bench, collaged from paint-flecked oak scavenged from the shells of older houses. Someone else is making jam, the big copper kettle heated by a propane ring. Perfect for Tessa, she thinks. The bridge people maintaining their interstices, doing their little things. But Chevette has seen them drunk. She has seen the drugged and the mad dive to their deaths in the gray and unforgiving chop, has seen men fight to the death with knives, has seen a mother, dumbstruck, walking with a strangled child in her arms at dawn. The bridge is no tourist's fantasy. The bridge is real, and to live here exacts its own price. It is a world within the world, and if there be such places between the things of the world, places built in the gaps, then surely there are things there, and places between them, and things in those places too. And Tessa doesn't know this, and it is not Chevette's place to tell her. She ducks past a loose flap of plastic into moist warmth and the spectrum of grow lamps, a reek of chemicals, black water pumped amid pale roots. These are medicinal plants, she supposes, but probably not drugs in the street sense. Those are grown nearer Oakland, in a sector somehow allotted for that, and on warm days there the fug of resin hangs narcotic in the air, bringing an almost perceptible buzz, faint alteration of perception and the will. Hey, anybody here? Gurgle of liquid through transparent tubing.
A silt-slimed pair of battered yellow waders dangle nearby, but no sign of who hung them there. She moves quickly, her feet remembering, to where corroded aluminum rungs protrude from fist-sized blobs of super-epoxy. The ball chain zip pulls on Skinner's old jacket jingle as she climbs. These rungs are a backway, an emergency exit if needed. Climbing past the sickly greenish sun of a grow lamp housed in a corroded industrial fixture, she pulls herself up the last aluminum rung and through a narrow triangular opening. It is dark here, shaded by walls of rain-swollen composite. Shadowed where she remembers light, and she sees that the bulb above in this enclosed space is missing. This is the lower end of Skinner's funicular, the little junkyard elevator trolley, built for him by a black man named Fontaine, and it was here that she'd lock her bike in her messengering days after shouldering it up another less covert ladder. She studies the cog-toothed track of the funicular, where the grease shows dull with accumulated dust. The gondola, a yellow municipal recycling bin, deep enough to stand in and grasp the rim, waits where it should. But if it is here, it likely means that the current resident of the cable tower is not, unless the car has been sent in expectation of a visitor, which Chivette doubts. It is better to be up there with the car up. She knows that feeling. Now she climbs wooden rungs, a cruder ladder of 2x4s, until her head clears the ply and she winces in wind and silvery light. She sees a gull hang almost stationary in the air, not 20 feet away, the towers of the city as backdrop. The wind tugs at her hair, longer now than when she lived here, and a feeling that she can't name comes like something she has always known. And she has no interest in climbing farther, because she knows now that the home she remembers is no longer there, only its shell humming in the wind, where once she lay wrapped in blankets, smelling machinist's grease and coffee and fresh-cut wood. Where, it comes to her, she was sometimes happy, in the sense of being somehow complete, and ready for what another day might bring. And knows she is no longer that, and that while she was, she scarcely knew it. She hunches her shoulders, drawing her neck down into the carapace of Skinner's jacket, and imagines herself crying, though she knows she won't, and climbs back down. 20. Boomzilla. Boomzilla sitting on the curb beside the truck these two bitches say they pay him to watch. If they don't come back, he'll get some help and strip it. Wants that robot balloon the blonde bitch had. That's fine. Fly that shit around. Other bitch kind of biker-looking. Big old coat looked like she got it off a dumpster. That one kick-your-ass looked like. Where they gone? Hungry now. Wind blowing grit in his face. Splashes of rain. Have you seen this girl? Movie-looking white man, face painted dark like they do down the coast. How they dress when they had time to think about coming here, everything worn out just right. Leather jacket like he's left his old airplane around the corner. Blue jeans, black tee. Boomzilla, he'd puke anybody try to put him in that shit. Boomzilla know how he going to dress time he get his shit together. Boomzilla looking at the printout the man holds out, sees the biker-looking bitch, but dressed better. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.